is October 27, 2007. It is 10:15. We are in room 2506, the Daly Center, Cook County Court Building, where we are interviewing Judge Eugene Pinchum about his legal career, his background, how he became a judge in the Cook County system, and his personal reflections on the duty. Thank you, Judge Pinchum, for agreeing to talk with us. What we'd like to talk about first is, you're in Chicago, but you did not grow up here. Can you tell us about where you grew up and what it was like?
I was born in Chicago, and my mother, I was the second child of my mother and father. My brother's 11 months older than me. Thus separated from my dad when I was about 5 months old. And she moved back to Limestone County, Athens, Alabama, where she was reared. And that's where I was reared. It was a rural cotton farming community, extremely impoverished, indigent, impecunious, underprivileged, and poor. Began school as a in kindergarten, 1929, and that was the beginning of the Great Depression. School I attended was founded in 1866 by an organization called the American Missionary Association, which was an abolitionist organization. In the Civil War and before the Civil War. After the war ended, 1865, this organization and its personnel, missionaries, came south, protected by Union soldiers, freed the emancipated slaves to become assimilated into a free society. And I recognize that in your high school and college curriculum, history gave you probably one paragraph, no more than a page, about slavery and emancipation. It indeed was a 200-year episode in American history. And when the war ended, the South had lost the war. The South had lost many, many soldiers, were killed in the war. Part of the South had been plundered Union troops during the war. I'm sure you heard of Sherman's March to the Sea. And there was extreme hostility and anger in the South by the Southern aristocracy and power structure, rising out of losing the war, losing their slaves, losing their means of earning a livelihood, and indeed losing out of between the agrarian society and the industrial society. The missionaries, many people perceived that when the war, slavery ended, the slaves would make a mass exodus to the North, which was untrue, and they didn't. One of the reasons they didn't was because they didn't know about freedom in the North. They had no means of getting to the North, and they had no sense of direction to go. Many of them stayed in the South, on the plantations, some of whom were allowed to leave. There was hostility against these missionaries who came. As an aside, American Missionary Association founded other schools in the South. And during the post-Civil War period, Southern states passed laws making it a crime, a felony, to teach blacks to read and to write. And made it a felony for a black to learn to read or to write. The laws were passed on the books in Southern states. And obviously there were no schools for blacks during slavery or after slavery, founded by the local power structure. The missionaries came from the American Missionary Association. There were other missionary organizations as well. And they founded such prestigious colleges in the South as Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, Moyne College in Memphis, Tennessee, Talladega College in Talladega, Alabama, Berea College in Berea, Kentucky, Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi, Dillard University in New Orleans, Louisiana. Also founded many, many grammar and high schools, one of which was Trinity School in Athens, Limestone County, Alabama, founded in 1866. The missionaries came and were indeed in a very hostile environment. School itself was built on what had been a fort that was built by Union troops during the Civil War. One of the major battles of the Civil War was fought in Limestone County, Coleman Hill, Alabama. Missionaries built a house in which they lived in the time when they were there, coming there, called the Teacher's Home. White, Presbyterians, Quakers, Methodists, Baptists. School had been there since, as I said, 1866, and I started school in 1929. They were extremely dedicated. They had to have been dedicated to have done what they did, having done what they did for so long, being in a hostile environment, extremely hostile. Yankee soldiers, or Union soldiers, occupied the South after the Civil War, yet the newly emancipated slaves. I believe it was 1870. James Tilden was the Democratic Party candidate for president of the United States out of New York. Rutherford B. Hayes was a Republican candidate for president. Tilden won most votes in the election house. But some of the electoral college votes were being contested. Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. What state was a northern state? I can't recall which one it was. Tilden was unable to gain the necessary majority votes in the electoral college. Stalemate, although he won the most popular votes, enough votes to win electoral college votes because of the conflict arising out of those four states. And Tilden, I beg your pardon, Hayes promised the southern states, Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina, that if they would give him their electoral votes in the presidential election, he would remove the Yankee soldiers from the South. Well, they didn't teach you this in history. And because of that, the southern states gave Rutherford B. Hayes electoral votes, and he was elected president of the United States. I believe the year was 1877. To his word, when he elected, he did withdraw Yankee troops from the South, protecting missionaries and the carpetbaggers and the newly emancipated slaves who were there. Chaos reigned in the South among blacks when the Yankee soldiers were removed, were protecting them. How these missionaries survived is a mystery to me, but they did. There was no public school in my hometown above the third grade. The school that I attended was Trinity. And it went from the kindergarten to the 12th grade. I did before I began in 19. I did not realize as I grew up to which they were indoctrinating me, influencing my judgment, influencing me as a person. As I said, they were extremely committed, they were extremely religious, devout Christians, too devout. If you walked in front of someone and say, excuse me, they would stop you and hold a prayer meeting without having said, excuse me, when you walked in front of somebody. That sounds somewhat harsh, I should say, but in reality, appreciating the fact coming out of slavery, blacks were not taught these niceties of culture. Blacks were not taught these elements of culture. Somebody handed you something, you didn't say thank you, you would stop and hold a sermon for you. Killed you for 20 minutes. You were committed. Many people in the community were able to attend the school only during the season when there was crops to be planted or harvested. Very, very adamant about the children who were going to school. My mother was a domestic servant. She was trying to go to school to become, ultimately did become a country school. I could not bring home a B on my grade book. It was a no-no. It's just, there was no debate, no discussion about it. 3 days. And it was instilled in us that you must make A's, you must do your best academically. Or, and so it happened yesterday, I was in the second grade, teacher was Miss Annie D. Mitchell, plus, I forget what it was in, but what were the subjects, reading, writing, arithmetic, spelling, social conduct, I forget what the B plus was in. I refused to leave school with plus on my record. And I argued with her, dramatically, of course. I can't go home with this. I can argue with, I guess, seemingly to me, a good hour. I'm sure it was not that long. But she finally agreed. I persuaded her to change it. Said, I'll change it. And she wrote over the B plus A. I went home with A on my coursework. My mother looked at it. She said, you changed that yourself. And she wouldn't. Well, I didn't. That's how strong about doing your best. And I was taught this. I was taught this by my mother. I was taught these by these missionary teachers, that it is a sin. It didn't grain within me that if you mop the floor, mop at your best, you're sinning. Looks cruel and you don't do your best, you're sinning. I played football. If you don't do your best, you're sinning. If you don't practice as hard, you're sinning. All that from the time you this happened, you begin to espouse to always do your best. I was also taught, nurse taught us, that God has given you life. No man or woman chose his or her birth parents, his or her birthplace. Not your choice. Somebody made that decision for you. By divine order. First, that you were born a female. Secondly, you were born white. You didn't have anything to do with that. They taught us and indoctrinated us that all human life has one purpose. It's to use your life to make better the lives of somebody else. You can see how missionaries espouse that philosophy. We're using our lives. We're coming from the north, the comforts, conveniences, pleasures of home, and literally to this wilderness and this hostile atmosphere, better the lives of somebody else, others. Deeply indoctrinated. This, in your formative years, is meaningless. I shouldn't say meaningless, but it's not as meaningful in 12 as it is when you're 50. As you get older, it becomes more meaningful. Also taught something else. Going to church was a must on Sunday. There was no debate, no question, no argument. But up on Sunday morning, you go to church. It was a religious, it was also a social event. By the fields and working, domestic service or whatever. Another, socialize as well as to who in our household was, if you breathe on Sunday, you go to church. Our church, about 2 miles from where we live, you walk. And south in the summer, it's hot. And Sunday morning, my brother was whining, I don't want to go to church, it's too hot, I don't want to go to church. I don't want to go to the church, it's too hot, I don't want to walk all that far, I have to walk all the way back. You had to go from the time you went to school, it's 9 o'clock. Church 11 until about 1. From 1 o'clock, you could come back home or you could stay down at the church. Then you go back to Epithet League at 6. I don't want to go in there. It's too hot. Mother said, I told you, son, if you breathe here, you go to church on Sunday. I said, if I breathe, I got to go. She said, yes. If I don't breathe, I don't have to go. She said, if you don't breathe, you can't go. Well, I'm not going to breathe. And he held his breath. I'm going to go breathe. And in holding his breath, the teacher took over, and he fell. He fainted. He hit the floor, blah! Eyes began to wall in his head, tongue came out of his mouth, saliva started coming out of his nose and mouth, scared me to death. Come on over here, he's dying. She looked at him. Pretty soon, nature again took over, and he began to breathe. What? See, he's breathing again. She said, well, let's go to church. I graduated, everything, and community, cows, chop cotton, pick cotton, gardens, put a boy at the grocery store. I did not know at the time, September of 1941, I was in the 11th grade. In the middle of October, I was promoted to the 12th grade. About March of 42, graduated, came to Chicago. I thought it was because I was smart. Just arrogantly, I said, because realistically, I was a good student. It made me be a good student. I was considered to be a black rabble-rouser in Alabama. I didn't know this at the time. And there was beginning to build a resentment by the white power structure against me. Because smart and would. When my mother found out about it, so the school that I attended discovered it, decided the best thing for me to get me out of Athens. Me and I graduated, came very, very poor. House did not have any screens. Mosquitoes or the bugs would fly by. They'd say, don't go in there. If you go in there, they'll suck your blood. It leaked. It rained. First task was to get the kitchen pots and pans on the beds to keep the beds dry. I would fall into the pans instead of in the bed. We'd go outdoors and sit on a tree to keep it getting wet. I grew up thinking, and this is true, everybody went to bed hungry. My mother would stand up at the table while my brother and I would eat, and I didn't know she did it as I grew up. When I finished eating, she'd take what we left and sop the plate. We got through growing up. Now, I want you to look at me with pity. A good time. I enjoyed it. The advantage I had was, or one of the advantages, over and above the advantages I see with children in Chicago, for example. We were poor and knew it. Underprivileged and knew we were underprivileged. Especially about children in Chicago and don't know it. Underprivileged and don't know it. And the reason they don't know it is because their environment is limited to where they are. That's all they see. It's where they are and their environment. Conversely, when I grew up, over here, and the affluent whites were over here. And we worked for the affluent whites. They were filled with food, homes, well-heated homes, cars, clothing. We could see it every day. We could see the difference between over here where we were and over there where they were. We aspired to get from over here to over here. And these missionaries taught us something else. All wealth comes out of the ground. Because all wealth comes out of the ground. You look shocked, but it does. It's the ground. The glass, this vase, this is plastic. I thought it was glass, but it comes from oil. This upholstery on this chair is leather. Leather comes from cow eats grass. Grass grows. On shoes, leather. Leather comes from a cow. Cow eats grass. Water. Retention. A few things that God replenishes is body and air, which man can't control. On the ground. I drove down here today in a car. Car's made out of metal. Metal's coming out of the ground. Wheels on the car has rubber tires. Tires may come from a rubber tree on the ground. The energy that was used to get me here was gasoline. Comes out of the ground. Everything comes out of the ground. We were taught this. God ain't gonna make no more ground. He made all the ground he's gonna make. Gonna make no more. Didn't get any ground. So we were enslaved. One of the reasons the Europeans were able to conquer and control North America when they came here was because Europeans had the concept that you can own land. Indians' concept was that you can't own land except where you stand. Indians' concept was you can no more own land than you can own a river or the lake. And so when the Europeans came and settled, Indian just kept moving back into the interior. And when it finally dawned on him that they were about to take his land permanently, it was too late. This. Because God ain't gonna make no more land something you must do to acquire some wealth. One of the things you can do to acquire wealth is to get some in your head. The advantage of knowledge is you sell it and it's inexhaustible. So you get an education and have skill. How you go academically, the more unique the skill. The more unique the skill, the money you make. The reason doctors make money is because everybody can't be a doctor. It's a unique skill. So he sells his knowledge. And isn't the same thing true with a lawyer? Same thing is true with the professor who just walked in. He's selling his knowledge. Thought that you, as I grew up, get something in your head to sell and you live a better life and you serve better and make the lives of others better by left home in the winter.
Sir. Yeah. Was it the hostile environment that you being called, or a hostile environment affected?
My grandmother, my mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, was Sophronia. She was a domestic servant for a family called the Ingrams. She would clean up, wash clothes, iron clothes. She made $3 a week. Off day was on Thursday afternoon. All the domestic servants in Athens, Limestone County had off day on Thursday afternoon. My grandmother was able to go to church on Sunday because she had to work. So occasionally she would be able to come to church on Sunday night. She was very cunning, very, very intelligent, extremely intelligent. I didn't say educated, but just education. She was not, but she's extremely intelligent. And she contributed to my religious spirit. It was a mandatory custom where I reared for blacks to say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, to white folks. I said no, sir. And she taught me how to talk to white folks without saying yes, sir, and no, sir. And it was a challenge. It was an intellectual challenge, an intellectual and social challenge, really. Why did you get the garbage out? Instead of saying, yes, sir, I said, sure did. You going to be on time when you come to work in the morning? I'm going to be at 6 o'clock. See Miss Jones downtown? Look right at her. It was my way of defying the custom. I went to Lemoyne College in Memphis in 1942, September. Got a job, houseboy, domestic servant, in Memphis with a family named Slater. I should never forget it, S-L-A-T-E-R. He was one of the town's major commercial electricians. Very wealthy, very palatial mansion. And I have always been a good worker. I was doing, know how to wash dishes, know how to clean up, know how to serve, know how to wait table, know how to make up a bed, know how to mop a floor, know how to rake leaves, know how to wash a car. And I worked for her about a month. And she and her husband called me in and fired me. And, of course, I wanted to know why. That's the kind of question. What did I do wrong? She said, you work well. Something about you. I knew what she was talking about, but I act like I didn't. You're just not like the others. And I just can't explain it. You're just not like the others. And what she meant was I wasn't bowing and scraping and scratching my butt when I wasn't itching. And smiling when there wasn't nothing funny. So that part of my personality, my being, hacking things that I perceive to be wrong and unjust, have mind my concerns about the Father. If I'm satisfying him, I don't give a damn whether I'm satisfying you or not. Since, of course it does. I don't want to be offensive to you. Listen to you, but the bottom line is my concern is him, not you. So what's your next question? Good question. Very good question. I worked at Children's Memorial Hospital on Fullerton. See Eric Lincoln, Dr. Lincoln, was world sociologist, and I was the first blacks to be employed there. Had to mop floors in the basement because they wouldn't let us above the first floor because they went to Children's Memorial Hospital. Lived at the Y, 38th and Wabash. He paid the rent this week, and I'd climb the fire escape and sleep in the room. I'd pay the rent the next week. He'd climb the box dead until September when I went to look. What's your next question? College?
Yes.
That's a very good question, too. And Mrs. Slater fired me. got a job as a waiter in the Peabody Hotel. Peabody Hotel is a historical landmark. Today, as a matter of fact. And I was very successful as a waiter. I made a lot of money. A lot of money then. And I worked at night and supposedly went to school in the day. Went to Memphis. I'd never seen that many good-looking girls at one place in my life. And a conflict arose. A good time. Go to school. Difficult to do all three. Something had to give. So I went. My mother got a job at Lemoyne College in the cafeteria. She left Athens and came. And she saw I was messing up. Saw it too, for that matter. She said to me, well, since you just taken courses in age playing and age 101, and thought I enrolled and you sent me to school. I said, it's a good idea. Her job is a dietitian at a cafeteria, and she enrolled at Lemoyne. Sent her to Lemoyne. Simply, we're supposed to be classmates. She got her degree. After 2 years, they expelled me. And academics. I told me they didn't even want me in Memphis. I'm on the campus. In fact, they say we'd prefer you leave in Tennessee. I graduated in May of 40, back to Alabama and became his teacher. I left Memphis in September of 44 and went to State in Nashville. Back on the right track. After 2 years of matriculation at Lemoyne, its academic credits were computed and credit hours. All in physical education. But I back on the right track. And at Tennessee State, I enrolled every day. And I hastened to add, didn't buy a book the whole time I was there. Well, the reason for that was because I had an exceptionally good high school background. As a matter of fact, second year Tennessee State, of a class, SASA. I went to class a couple of days. Got the exam papers, I went back to class and cheap. Oh, blow, here's your paper. Susie Smith, here's your paper. Ann John, here's your paper. R. Eugene Pynchon, I don't see you in class. Where are you from? Alabama. Yeah. I'm seeing you in class. I say, I'm been. Here's your paper, you got 100. You got all right, which I did. And I know you couldn't have cheated because I made up the test as I put it on the board. Where'd you go to school? What kind of school is that? She couldn't believe it. The long story short, I said, Dr. Sass, I had this when I was in eighth grade at Trinity. Now, when I took the course and came to class and saw what it was, I knew I didn't need it, so I didn't come to class. She said, well, I'm not going to give you an A. You can keep from giving me an A. I made an A on the test. She said, because you didn't come to class. In order for you to pass this course, you're going to have to help me teach it. You have to come to class and teach it. And I became the assistant at teaching kids algebra. I was a good student. I was in the student council, vice president of senior class, full mark of my fraternity. Had a good time. But I worked. I did everything on the college campus, and stopping toilets, mopping floors, washing windows, spying the furnace on the campus. In fact, I lived in a dormitory called East Dormitory, the men's dormitory. The holiday seasons, for example, during Christmas, they turned the heat off in the men's dormitory. I couldn't go home because I didn't have money to go home. I had to stay on the campus. I'd go down to the boiler room because I knew other friends to turn the heat back on in East Dormitory. I'd sneak into the cafeteria where I worked also to get something to eat. I had a good time. Don't misunderstand. I met Tennessee State. I married August 31st, 2005. We were married 57 years. Children. Yes. He would indoctrinated, indeed, culturized as we grew up. As I said, you're going to college. Now, nobody told you how. There were no such thing back then as grants, such things as scholarships, such things as endowment. all the way through grammar and high school, you're going to college. It's just like, you're going to take a bath, you're going to college. Ongoing, during the time you're matriculating, there is a slight concern about what you're going to do when you get out, but not too much. You really can't worry about tomorrow. You don't get through today. And your immediate concern is surviving today. So what you're going to do when you get out, get out of college is not as much a concern as getting out of college, finishing college. Of course it comes across you, what I'm going to do, what I'm going to do with it, not a driving force. On graduation day, graduation speaker, Tennessee politician, he may have been the governor, I don't recall, but just what he made a very, very dynamic speech. He said, in essence, how do you think you finally made it? And all the graduates said, you have done well. And you're here at great sacrifice. Parents who are sitting in the balcony. Parents have worked in the kitchen, worked in the factories, worked in the fields. Send you here for education so you'd have a better life than they had. Proud of you. Said, but now that you're here and you're leaving here, what are you going to do with what you got here? A degree, what are you going to do with it? Bearing in mind that each department graduates are supposed to sit together. Graduation ceremony. My major was math and political science. Her friend's major was education. Sitting side by side during graduation. The speaker went on to say, what is it that you can do now as a result of being here that you couldn't have done if you had not come? And in there, what is it that I can do now as a result of being here? Could not do had I not come. He's blinking. He said, many of you, and bearing in mind this is all black school, many of you will leave here and go north, Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, and that was the migration of blacks. Apply for jobs on the police force, and some of you will get jobs as policemen. But you didn't need a college degree to catch a burglar coming out of a building, breaking into a building. You need a college degree to catch a robber. He said, some of you will go north and apply for jobs as firemen, which is true, which so many of us did. You didn't need a college degree to know to put water on a fire, put it out. He said, some of you will go north and get jobs in the postal service, U.S. Postal Service. Around Chicago today, you see most people working post office are black, which is an area which we were employed. So, but you didn't need a college degree to know Alabama from Tennessee, from Georgia, to real estate. He said, what are you going to do now? He said, unless you are willing to go further, use this degree as a foundation for another degree, they wasted your time coming here. He said, and you know it, parents will sacrifice to send you here, feed by you. After the ceremony, stood out in the class in front of the administration building. Who was on the second floor taking the class picture. I'm standing next to Alzada. The only reason I was able to march across the stage to get my degree was because the head of the math and political science department insisted to the dean that I march. Give him some money. You're not supposed to be able to march if you owe some money. He agreed to let me march. And on the condition that when I finished marching, I'd get my degree back until I paid the bill. So, as we were getting in formation to get the picture made, Ursa, who was the husband of my math teacher, he was Dr. Sasser, coming, picking up degrees of students that was getting degrees back. I saw him coming. I handed my degree to Al Zeta. And she stuck it down in the bosom. So when he got to me, I said, Dr. Sasser, you got mine. You have mine. He looked, okay, check mine off. So kept it. As far as years later, I had my degree laminated on walnut. It's on my wall today in my office. And it doesn't have a date on it. I didn't get it back in. It's signed, but it has no date on it. I was 8 and I discussed it. I did not want to go to medical school. There are two black medical schools in America, Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee, and Howard Medical School in Washington, D.C., Howard University. I knew all the faculty at Meharry Medical School because of my fraternity relationships. The president, the dean, the faculty members wanted me to go to med school. It's only about 8 or 10 blocks from Tennessee State. I did not want to go to medical school, basically because I didn't know at the time. I had avoided all of the hard science courses in going to college. Dodged them. I thought it was a misconception on my part that in order to be a doctor, you need the basic science courses. I didn't know then at the time. I now know. I know a girl had a major in Spanish, went to med school. She's a doctor today. My daughter's a doctor today. But at that time, I was of the impression and the perception that you needed physical science courses, physics and biology and chemistry and all that, to be a doctor. I knew I didn't have the courses, so I said, I don't want to be a doctor, Dennis. At that time, the only other avenue was being a lawyer or going into the divinity. I should have gone to the clergy, but I didn't. I went to law school. I applied. Up at Harvard, Yale, Northwestern, University of Chicago, Stanford. In Chicago, because since my dad was here. And I'd been here in 42. So I came to Chicago and ended up here.
How did your dad influence your dad? Did you say your dad?
My dad was here, yes. My dad was a good man. I'm blessed that my mother grew up would not allow us to hate him. There's a tendency on the part of children when they're separated from their dad, particularly a lot of them as we were, never got his toys. We never got his clothes. We were too poor. Always blamed our dad. And my mother would hear us saying something negative about him. No, don't you say anything negative. He's your father. He would send you something if he had. No, he wouldn't. He didn't care anything about yakety, yakety, yakety. And to persuade us and to convince us not to be negative about him, whenever she heard us say anything negative about him, she'd make us sit down and write him a letter. And you can remember, I'm sure, when you were 10, 11 years of age, I held you writing a letter. Sit down, write him a letter. Dear Dad, tell him you love him. I love you. Bye. Tell him why you love him. I love you. Why do I love him, Mama? I love you because you're my dad, sincerely. Tell him what you did in school today. I love you because you're my dad. I went to school today. Goodbye. Tell him what you did in school today. I went to school today. And so to avoid that discipline, we would never let our mother hear us say anything negative about him. And fortunately for us, that was the case because inherent within that discipline, we were taught to respect him and love him. So when I came here in 42, I lived at the Y. He lived at 9518 South Yale. Worked at International Harvest. Matter of fact, he worked there. And he insisted that I come live with him. I refused. Not because I didn't like him, but the guys that I had left home with in Athens were living at the Y. And I wouldn't live at the Y with them. Well, you know, I can make you come. I said, no, you can't either. He said, well, if you insist, you stay at the Y, which I did. On the weekends, I'd go out to his house and stay with him. A supporter came back to go to law school. I lived with him first semester. I enrolled in Northwestern in January of 1948. Al Zeta and I had decided to get married after I finished law school. As you know, the law school is over on Chicago Avenue in Lakeshore Drive. I was in the classroom over the lake during class. See Al Zeta coming up out of the water. My mind wasn't on them books. My mind was on her. And after my first semester, law school was at that point in my academic, extremely unique because up until this point in my life, we had been taught actual precision. 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 2 = 4. Thomas came to America, October 12, 1492. You go to law school, it's different. Because there are always two sides. 1 + 1 could be 11, be 11 if you put the 1 next to the 1. 2 + 2 could be 22 if you put the 2 next to the 2. It took me a semester to realize that the law is an adversary proceeding. two sides. Both sides think they're right. And the judge has to make the decision as to which one is right. And the fact that the judge may make the decision doesn't mean the judge is right, but somebody has to be right, somebody has to be wrong. So my first semester was difficult, the reasons I stated, as well as emotionally I was stable because I was thinking about my girlfriend. Well, that summer, I told her, I'm not going to make it through unless we get married. At August 31st, 1948, at his living room in front of the fireplace. She came to Chicago in December of 48. Upstairs, his house, he had a two-flat building. A apartment upstairs over him, sauna, room, guest room, all in one room. She taught school in the Chicago public school system for 10 years while our children were born. Law school was extremely rewarding. I was only black in my class. One woman in the whole law school, Drosschild was her name, you know, who became the chairman of Washington, was a semester behind me in law school. Several classes together. And recognized that I was a genius. I worked at the Palmer House as a waiter, 5:30 until 1 o'clock, pot room. And the man who hired me, Richard Davis, a man named Jackie, told me, don't let anybody here know you're going to school, because of the dual hand. After the dinner hour was over, allowed me to leave my station in the dining room, and in the laundry room, put me a tent out of tablecloths and the laundry hampers, and hide and study my lessons. Somebody in the hotel did discover I was in school and insisted to Mr. Jaffe that I'd be fired. He refused to fire me. And they threatened to fire him. She said, no, I'll quit. She said, no, you don't have to quit. So the waiter stood behind him. Management of the Empire Room discovered that they were having an employment problem. Backed off and just said he'd fire me. So I stayed there until I graduated. Jaffe was, how can I put it, I sit here on a whole lot of people's shoulders, here by myself, recognize that reality, and life has been hopefully recognizing that reality. Many a day in law school, many a day I had to stand up at my desk, keep from going to sleep. Every semester I was expelled because I couldn't pay my bill. Bursa was a lady named, what happened to you when you get my age? Hello, Klepak. Well, Klepak was a bursar.
Mr. Pansy, I have to give you an expulsion notice. You have not paid your bill. The Board of Trustees of Northwest University has decreed that you cannot enroll for a subsequent semester without paying all your bills for the past semester. So you cannot enroll this semester.
I don't have money to pay you.
I know that, so therefore you can't come back this semester. Well, I'll be back.
Didn't miss a class in 3 years. Someone would say to me after class, I'll never forget it one day. It's a pinch I'm going to see after class.
Well, I have an expulsion notice for you. What? You're not supposed to be in class. I know it. He said, why are you here? I said, I'm here to learn. He said, I'm not going to let you in the class. I said, well, you're going to have to fight me. And I know you can't whip me. You try to put me out, you're going to have to fight me. Now, it's up to you. I'm coming back tomorrow. He said, you mean? I said, damn right I mean it. I think you do. I said, no question about it. That's because I don't have no money. I said, you call the police, they're going to ask you, you mean you're putting him out of school because he don't have no money? How dare you? He said, I graduated owing the money. I got sworn in as a lawyer in Springfield owing them money. Ms. Klepak gave me a permission, and if you don't know this, it's a cardinal rule. That to be sworn in as a lawyer, you must have all of your financial commitments satisfied and statements from all your financiers, the bookstore, the law school, everybody that you paid up. I didn't have to do that. Ms. Klepak gave me a pass. I got sworn in. I stand on a lot of people's shoulders. And I didn't get it by myself. For that, you want to know.
You talked about you were the only black in your class in law school. Can you tell us what it was like? Did it make a difference to studying?
No, it did not. In reality, I recognized immediately upon first class that there were some students there with whom I could not compete academically. not because of an inferior education that I might have had, because my academic background was just as good as theirs. I recognize that there's a kid sitting next to me who's comes from four generations of lawyers. Another kid sitting over here, his dad is a governor of Indiana. His granddad is a governor of Indiana. There's another kid sitting here, his uncle's justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia. Dad was a steel worker. I recognize that it's futile to compete with them academically, or to compete with myself. And so, academically, it was rewarding because I had been the top of my class throughout my high school and college career, except in Des Moines. I accept the reality that I'm not going to be the order of corps. I'm not going to be the honor student. That's forward. Historically, Northwestern University has refused to allow the various schools to have independent, separate graduations. All of the university schools have the same graduation: medical school, dental school, law school, school of general business, reasons which I do not yet know. In 1978, law school was given permission by the Board of Trustees to have an independent graduation ceremony. I was invited speaker service, and I told them at this graduation, related to you, that this is the first graduation. I'm indeed honored to be invited to be the good speaker. I graduated from law school. One of my classmates graduated magna cum laude. Some graduated summa cum laude. Graduated order of coif. I graduated, thank you, Lordy. Competition academically, not a problem. I was a good student. I didn't have the time to do my assignments. I did what I could. I never missed a class in the whole time I was there, three years, six semesters. By the time I didn't know what the hell was going on, but I was there. It was a good run. I enjoyed it. Curriculum needs to be changed in law school. I'm going to do it because historically it's... I took the bar, passed the first time. I said a 2 out of 50. I said some kind of way. The concept of a bar exam is flawed. It's flawed because our laws are written. Why should you have to maintain all this knowledge in your head if when there's a book that's got the information you need? So law school should be a course on reference work. How do you find what you're looking for rather than remembering what they're trying to teach you? Enjoy it. I was supportive?
Yes.
She was supportive. We started dating. Extremely supportive in law school. Extremely supportive in my career as a lawyer. Her dad sent her every week to Tennessee State a letter with a $2 money order in it. A money order every week. Yeah. The girl who ran the post office at Tennessee State was a girl named Thelma Baxter. She's still living in Nashville today. I would go to the post office. Thelma knew that Alzada and I were courting. I'd make Thelma give me Alzada's mail. I'd open up the mail. And I'd take the $2 money order out and give Thelma the letter back and take the money order and just cash it. Alzada gets the letter with no money order. Jane, you give me a dollar, you keep a dollar. I'd give a dollar. I mentioned to you she taught school for 10 years from January of 1949 until March of 1959, she taught school. Three children in the room. She never cashed a check. The check would come in the mail. And our check came today, it's on the dresser. Deep Southern cultured roots. Even supported. I would never try a case without first talking to her about it. I won many a case in the court because of her. She had mountain reasoning and logic. Extremely supportive, never combative, never competitive. I'd be trying a case. Recess, got in the car. The panel, man, you cross-examine her. Ooh, you bad lawyer. She'd stand over in the corner. And then people get through patting me on the back. She said, can't you see juror number 10 hates your guts? Leave me. No, you so, you hung up on what you're doing, who you are.
said, "Your number 10 hates you." She said, "Watch me, I'm telling you." She said, "I'm watching her. Whenever you turn your back, she gnashes her teeth, rolls her eyes at you, and punches them." True story. I went back. I accepted what she said. And on, I addressed juror number 10. Everything I do, I'm talking to her. And I would take my eyes off of her, juror number 10. And finally, she felt she was being ignored. And she ended up being the foreman of the jury that won the case. I would experiment with her during trial. And she would say to me, "No, that ain't gonna work, honey. I want it to work. I'm the lawyer, I'm the one went to law school. You didn't go." "Well, I'm telling you, I didn't go to law school, but I'll tell you, that ain't gonna work." She'd say to me, "Now how are you, if you can't convince me and you're sleeping with me, how in the hell are you gonna convince a jury and they don't even know you?" Supporter. But that's common sense. And law school, and I teach law courses, and I'm the privilege of lecturing at Harvard. As a matter of fact, I go there twice a year. Northwestern, Notre Dame, Arizona, Stanford, Cornell. Law school makes a fool out of you. So with 3 years of listening to these professors lecturing, pounding on desks and crap, there are various categories or phases in the law. You have a lawyer who teaches, a lawyer who practices, and a lawyer who's a judge. And when you are in an academic environment from kindergarten, high school, years of college, years of law school, these are your formative years. And you have not had human exposure during that period of time. So you arrive at a point where you have a distorted mind after you're going through all this. You don't think like lay people. And my wife would always say to me, "You're thinking like a lawyer, think like a lay person." And I won many a case because of her advice. Lawyers around nowadays, lawyers don't decide cases, jurors decide cases. Jurors don't think like lawyers. Jurors think like lay people. And they're the smartest people in the world. They have a JD and Phi Beta Capital. You really, they outthink you. They can. And bearing in mind too, as Al Zeta pointed out to me, jurors don't have the opportunity to ask questions. I can't tell you that I don't hear. And in all my years of practice, I've never heard a juror raise their hand and say, "I can't hear." Now, you know damn well in all these years, some of them ain't heard a thing going on. But they will not do that. So it's important. I found that she was very, very, very understanding. But too busy to listen to what I had to say about a case. Always go to the scene with me of a crime or the scene of an incident. One case is going to the scene. Well, sure, sure. Yeah, sure.
And then we'll get into
all right.
The cook-up.
Okay.